Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Chris Scully. Today we will be hearing from Troy Mayor Patrick Madden once again regarding some current issues in the city.
And we'll be joined by Shelley Hegan, who will be speaking about Planned Parenthood.
And later on, we'll be following up on our previous segment regarding the tenant rights in Troy with Laura Feltz of the United Tenants of Albany.
After that, we'll hear from L.A. Kaufman in regards to an upcoming workshop on Thursday at the Sanctuary for Independent Media.
Finally, we will speak with HMM's Elizabeth Press on queer parenting. Now, let's start off the show with some headlines.
In a recent meeting, members of the Rensselaer County Legislature introduced a resolution urging New York State lawmakers to vote against the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. The act would aid farm workers in their fight to gain rights to overtime pay, a rest day per week, and workers' compensation for injuries on the job. The Rensselaer County Legislature has argued that the act would create drastic changes to the farming industry that will lead to much higher labor costs for family farms. Legislator and farmer Chuck Peter stated that collective bargaining, overtime, and mandatory time off for their workers would be economically unsustainable for small, family-owned farms. This ongoing struggle between small farm owners and their laborers highlights an often unseen injustice within the food industry. The lack of labor rights in the farming industry stem from a Jim Crow legacy that many hope to put an end to.
This past weekend, a cyber attack on Albany's documentation and record services caused some distress. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan took to social media to announce that there had been a ransomware cyber attack on the city. In cases such as these, a hacker denies an owner access to their own system or files, generally with demands of a ransom. Sunday evening, Sheehan tweeted that city officials had been working through the weekend in order to address the incident. As of today, all city services, except birth, death, and marriage certificates, were open to the public. The vice president of the Albany Police Officers Union, Gregory McGee, wrote that members do not have access to services requiring internet, which means that service calls to the department may take longer than usual, sparking debates about the security of the police system, which contains sensitive information on the city and its individuals.
Albany Center Gallery has launched a new program called Corner Canvas, which will allow students to create murals to be displayed in vacant lots and boarded-up homes. The program will work with students from the South End, West End, and Arbor Hill neighborhoods to reinvigorate the public spaces in these areas with vibrant art from the students. The program hopes to foster collaboration and creativity for the students of Albany. Ages for the program range from elementary school to high school, bringing kids together and fostering a sense of community pride.
Despite the majority of voters supporting it and general support within the state legislature, marijuana legalization failed to make it into this year's budget for the state of New York. Only one of the American states that has legalized cannabis has done through state legislation, Vermont. The rest of the states have done so through ballot initiatives. The failure to make it into this year's budget has come from competing visions of what a just transition to a legal regime for cannabis looks like. The governor has provided many guideline suggestions from large cannabis businesses, such as banning home cultivation, while social justice advocates from within the Senate are arguing that the communities most negatively impacted by the war on marijuana to directly benefit from the legalization. Governor Cuomo now vows to pass recreational marijuana legalization by June as a standalone bill.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Now, let's go to HMM's Corinne Carey as she speaks with Troy Mayor Patrick Madden on cannabis legalization, Monument Square, politics, and more from within Troy.
Is there anything that you're keeping your eye on with respect to the pending state budget? Well, I'm very curious about the cannabis legislation and where that's going to go. At this point in time, I think the winds are blowing against it being included as part of the budget. But I think inevitably it will pass. And so we need to be prepared for that in terms of zoning, where we would allow and not allow dispensaries, how we deal with the security issues, because, as you know, it's a cash transaction. You can't open a bank account in a federally insured bank. So there are issues that we have to prepare for, and this could come rather quickly. So that's something that I'm trying to keep on top of, but it's something I'm watching with great interest on the state level. I didn't expect it to come this quickly, but I think it's inevitable.
Any update on the pool situation?
We are out to bid for the South Troy pool. I think the bid return date is, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the 25th of this month. So we're very eager to see what responses we get. It was a relatively quick turnaround time, but the specs were very thorough. So if people sat down right away, I think they could put some, that there was sufficient time to do a proper bid. And then we want to get underway as quickly as we can and get the project started. Ideally, we would complete the project by July 1, but we'll see what the contractors tell us when we open the bids. If that's too tight a time frame, what I would like them to do, and this would be something we would negotiate with them, is to at least do the pool. And then the changing rooms and bathrooms could be done after the season concludes. But at least let's get the pool open.
Mayor, I took a hike in Prospect Park during mm-hmm. the last snow, and my husband and I went and visited the remains, I guess, of the Wesley Bintz pool.
Isn't that something?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there any chance that anyone could be attracted to look at that pool and say, this is sort of an architectural gem and mm-hmm. we need to restore it?
Well, I like to tell people I can do anything that they want to pay for. And I can't imagine what that pool would cost to renovate. My guess is you're somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 million. And then, of course, you have to budget each year to run it and to maintain it. And it's an old structure, so it's going to require some maintenance. I'd love to. And when I came into office, I dreamed that maybe I'd be the one that could reopen that pool. But I'm struggling to keep the ones that we have, get those reopened at a much smaller price tag. It's something pretty special. We haven't been able to find anybody who's interested in writing that check for us, but we're still looking.
Well, I wish you all the luck with that, because it really is a gem. It would be great to have that back. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about Rodney Wilshire primarying you for the office of mayor in the upcoming election, given how the Working Families Party strategy worked out last time around?
Well, the Working Families Party is endorsing me, and I'm endorsed by the Democratic Committee. You know, anybody is free to throw their hat in the ring if they're passionate about holding elected office. And I think that people will take a look at what we've been able to accomplish in the past 3 years. And I think they should be impressed by that. A lot has been accomplished in Troy. There's a lot on the boards right now. I'll put my record up against anybody when it comes to running for mayor in the city.
What do you think about the Troy Democratic Committee's decision to run Mary Sweeney in District 2, given that district's high percentage of African Americans and the actual reason for the vacancy?
I would love to see more African-American faces on the city council, and maybe Latino faces as well. But in District 2, there's a process you have to follow. In District 2, one minority person did apply to be interviewed by the Democratic Committee. But that person decided at the last minute that they didn't want to go forward. So there was not a minority option to run in D2. We do have a very qualified candidate who is a minority in District 1, and I look forward to working with her, and I'd love to see her sit on the council as well. But we need people to step up, and you know, there's a variety of reasons why people do and do not run for office. We want them running for office for the right reason.
Can you tell me the status of the Monument Square Farmers Market plan?
Well, I wouldn't blend the two just yet. Farmers Market is going through their own analysis to help them plot what their future might look like. If I was on that board, I'd be very nervous because everybody loves the market as it is now. And, you know, you don't want to tinker with success too much. It's a great market, well-regarded, and people come from Bennington, as far away as Bennington, probably further, but I know people regularly come from Bennington to go to it. In terms of One Monument Square, we had a great charrette process last summer, and a report came back in the fall from the consultants with some, you know, conceptual design work. We've been talking with the development community. We're pretty close to going out with a request for proposals now. We're looking for a developer who would be interested in redeveloping that site and who could hit as many of the priorities that the community identified as possible. The balance is going to be trying to make it work financially and creating the amount of public space that the public wanted. So, but we're open to, we'll be going out shortly. We'll be open to a lot more discussion on that moving forward. It's taking some time, but it's more important to get it right than get it fast.
About a week and a half ago, I was speaking with a state assembly member, John McDonald. Mm-hmm. We were talking about zombie properties and abandoned properties. And I know that there are more than 500 of them in Troy, a lot of them in Lansingburg, mm-hmm. around where I live. What assurances can you give people that regular residents of Troy have a chance at getting them rather than the best properties being funneled to developers?
A lot of the properties that are vacant are smaller 1-2 unit buildings that aren't attractive to developers. We're very much, I come from a background of
Absentee landlords. You know, I mean,
right.
Instead yeah. of, yep. I guess the concern is both developers and people from outside of Troy coming in to snatch up cheap, you know, cheap property to rent out. And I think the concern is residents might want to, you know, move out of rentals and take over,
right.
take over the mortgage on some of those properties.
Right. And I'm all for that. I'd love every one of those to be owner occupied at this point in time. We can't prohibit people from buying it. So what we need to do is make residents aware of the opportunity first, give them the tools they need to be able to buy some of these properties. So whether it's education through TRIP or assistance from TAP in terms of rehab that might need to be done, or Habitat for Humanity, or any of the great nonprofits we have in town, providing people the resources that they need to be able to secure one of these buildings and be successful at it. We don't want to set somebody up for failure. We can't pass a law, though, that says you have to live in property. That's just not something we have the authority to do. The properties that we own that we might take through a tax foreclosure or otherwise, those we can give priority to local people to buy and occupy those. And we usually do try to do that. It's more important for me to have an owner occupant in a particular building than to sell the building for $5,000 or $10,000 or $20,000 more to somebody from New York City who's going to manage it from afar. So we do have the ability to direct, at least in regards to the properties that the city owns.
Can you share the resources that someone looking to buy a home here in Troy might consult if they wanted to see the list of properties? Is that easily shareable?
Sure. What I would do is call TRIP's Home Ownership Center. When I used to be there, the number was 690-0020. Talk to them if you have questions about the condition of buildings, bringing somebody in to take a look at it to let you know how big a problem this or that might be. You would give TAP a call, 274-3050. So they should reach out to these nonprofits, maybe even reach out to Habitat for Humanity and see what might be available. They're terrific nonprofits. They add a lot of value. People go through the process and make smarter decisions about homeownership.
Is there anything that I didn't cover that you want to talk about?
You know, I would just encourage people to stay involved, to get involved in their neighborhood organizations, attend the meetings, become educated about the issues that are, you know, that we're wrestling with here in Troy. You know, get off Facebook, come to a meeting, meet people, talk about issues. You know, you don't always get what you want, but if you get smarter on certain issues, you can understand why steps are taken that are taken. So come on out, meet up with other people.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for your time.
That was Mayor Patrick Madden of the City of Troy speaking with media correspondent Corinne Carey on issues and politics in Troy.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady. Now let's hear from Laura Feltz of United Tenants of Albany as she speaks about some of the issues and rights for tenants of Troy.
My name is Dave Pablo, and I am in the studio today with Laura Feltz, who is the Homelessness Prevention Program Coordinator at United Tenants of Albany. And I met Laura the other day at a presentation about tenants' rights in Troy, and a lot of the stuff that she was talking about seemed to be of definite interest to Troy residents, and that's why I invited her into the studio today. So welcome.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit, first of all, what is United Tenants of Albany about, and what do you do, like, day in, day out?
Yeah, United Tenants is a small, local, nonprofit organization in Albany that's been around since 1973. Our mission is to protect and promote tenants' rights to safe, decent, and affordable housing, and we sort of do that in a number of ways. We have some direct services that assist tenants that are dealing with housing instability, and then we have some other larger level services that encompass community organizing, legislative advocacy. We provide trainings and education for tenants and landlords. So we kind of address the issue of housing instability in a number of ways.
Mm-hmm. What are you working on most, like, these days?
Oh my gosh, we do so much. Our housing hotline is a really heavily utilized service. We get 5,000 calls from tenants dealing with housing matters every year. We're going to court with quite a few people in Albany City Court in the morning. Those folks are facing eviction. We're going with around 300 people a year. We have a pretty heavy presence with the statewide campaign, the Upstate Downstate Housing Alliance, that's advocating for some pretty big legislative changes this year to give some more rights to tenants in New York State.
And I would think with the budget having just passed, that you were very active on that. Is that correct?
Yes, we had some great victories with this budget, so we're really happy.
Oh, let's talk about those.
Yes, the Neighborhood Preservation Program was fully funded this year, so we live to fight another year as a neighborhood preservation company. And the community's first funding was fully funded, so we are able to continue to provide services to tenants in foreclosure.
Okay. So, yeah, when I was going through some stuff earlier, writing down some of the things that you guys do, the housing hotline service was on there, and then the emergency rental assistance. So a lot of these things that you were just talking about, that's you're just trying to acquire funding, continued funding for things that are already existing, right?
Right. Yes. We didn't get any bumps in anything, but we are sustained.
Okay. Were there new things that you were trying to get across the board too?
Budget-wise, we were, for the most part, advocating for the same funding that we had been receiving. We were at risk of entirely losing that foreclosure prevention funding. It had been funded previously through settlement legal settlements that were won against banks during the housing crisis. And mm-hmm. So those funds had run out. And so we had to fight for it to be included in the New York State budget through sort of new sources.
Now, just so our listeners know, that program, that's about tenants who their landlords have their properties foreclosed upon. And so they're dealing with a brand new situation, whether the building is suddenly owned by a bank or by the city or by some new buyer, correct?
Right. Yes. It's the Home Ownership Protection Program. So it actually funds housing counselors that are assisting homeowners who are about to lose their homes to foreclosure. And then also it helps United Tenants provide that same assistance to tenants in foreclosure.
Mm-hmm. What are the situations that people get into with that? I mean, with Troy changing so rapidly, there are a lot of people buying houses, and a lot of them do come with existing tenants. Do you find that these new landlords try to, let's say, clean house, or do they try and accommodate people?
Well, so over the summer, the protections for tenants in foreclosed properties was reinstated. So folks are entitled to either the duration of their lease agreement or 90 days notice, whichever is greater, so long as the person who's purchased the house at foreclosure is not intending to occupy the home as their primary residence. So whether the new buyer likes it or not, the tenants that reside there do have some rights at this point.
And one of the things, when you were presenting in Troy the other day, it sounded like, I mean, almost all of your services are essentially restricted to Albany proper or Albany County. Are there other things that are available to Troy or Rensselaer County residents?
Through United Tenants?
Through your organization or maybe other sister organizations that you know, or is it that there is an absence of such things? And so then the question would basically morph into what kind of things would you like to see in our fair city?
Right. United Tenants does assist residents in Troy and Rensselaer County when they're dealing with foreclosure, tenants that are in foreclosed properties. We do assist a great number of folks in Troy and Rensselaer County with our housing hotline, but then those more kind of case management type services like court advocacy and emergency rental assistance are only for folks in the city of Albany or Albany County. And there's not really a court advocate in Rensselaer County or the city of Troy. There's not that type of service available, and that's something that I think would be hugely helpful. There mm-hmm. are a lot of evictions being filed in Troy, just as many as there are in Albany.
So does this mean that the tenants, they basically go in, unless they have brought their own attorney, which almost none will have done, they're basically doing it on their own, correct?
They are doing it on their own.
Okay. And have you spent time in court in Troy?
I have, yes.
And how lenient are the judges or magistrates involved?
Well,
I've heard on a number of occasions that landlords prefer Troy Housing Court to any other housing court in the capital area.
Interesting.
So it speaks for itself.
Yeah, it really does. Well, this came up at your talk the other day. What are the types of issues that are being presented? Is it just non-payment of rent, or are there other things involved?
There's a lot of holdover evictions in both areas, in Troy and in Albany.
So for people who aren't familiar with that term, that's basically when you have a lease and it doesn't go month to month after the termination of it. Correct?
Right. Or if you're a month-to-month tenant and you've been given a 30-day notice and you've remained past the date of that notice, those are the most common.
Yeah. That would seem to be perhaps the most traumatic kind of situation to get into, because you could have the rug basically pulled out from under you.
Yes. Landlords do not need to have a reason to give that type of a notice, and they can give it for any reason as long as it's not a retaliatory reason, which mm-hmm. is often very difficult to prove for tenants.
Right. With that one, would you basically need a paper trail?
Yes, and probably an attorney if you're going to win.
Okay. You guys have a document that is out for public use, actually a couple different things. There's a landlord and tenant responsibilities, know your rights. It's basic tenant responsibilities. And then there's another one, lease agreements, know your rights. And those are both really interesting and helpful, I would think, for most tenants. One of the issues that's listed on there are unenforceable lease terms. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those for a minute.
Sure. It's pretty common that in lease agreements, landlords try to take away your basic rights. We're always reminding folks at United Tenants that if you have a right afforded to you by public policy, it can't be taken away from you when you sign a contract. But it's important to look out for those lease clauses and to know what your rights are up front, because it could be a battle down the road if you sign it and then you're having to sort of fight to maintain that right for yourself.
What are some of the typical ones that are those unenforceable lease terms?
Common that a landlord will exempt themselves entirely from liability if something takes place at the apartment that's a result of their negligence. Also exempting themselves from having to keep a person's items safe and dry for a reasonable time if they are evicted. Those common things where they try to mitigate any potential financial damage that could come down the road.
Yeah, it sounds like a wishful thinking lease from a landlord's perspective. Are they pre-made by, you know, an organization for them, or are these landlords essentially just slapping these things together?
They're certainly not written in partnership with tenants, and tenants don't usually have any say when they're being written. We find that they do often find them online. There's some that are made available through organizations, and then attorneys often will help folks write them.
What kind of organizations?
There's an organization called CADARPO, Capital District something, Real Property Owners, and they help landlords kind of get a hold of materials that can help them. And even at the landlord training that United Tenants has partnered with folks to provide in Troy and in Albany, we provide a lease template.
Okay. We only have a couple minutes left, but I have a couple other questions for you. One of them is, it's very open-ended, but if you were trying to make changes that would make the rental housing system function a little bit better, especially for tenants, what would you do?
I think intrinsic to the issue is that we would have to come to a collective decision that a person's right to a safe, decent place to live is as important as somebody's right to own and profit off that place. there's got to be more public policy that affords tenants power that allows them to either, you know, take legal action against their landlord or just assert their rights, because now they're always on the defense and they're just always facing eviction with very little to pull off of. But I would say in Troy, there's so much potential, and there needs to be some kind of a rental dwelling regulation or registry system in the city of Troy to kind of deal with the overwhelming condition issues that they have, and also to address the absentee issue that they have in their area.
Is there anything like that in the works?
I've heard that there is, but I haven't seen anything. I've heard a little bit that maybe they're going to try to model something off of Albany's system. So I'm hopeful about that.
Okay. The last couple things, maybe if you could list off, and we've already kind of covered this a little bit, but other organizations that Troy residents might have access to. And also, as far as United Tenants of Albany, are there events that you guys have scheduled coming up, or contact information for people trying to reach out to you?
Sure. So for agencies for Troy, there are some agencies that provide emergency rental assistance. I believe Unity House, the Rourke Center, and the Center for Economic Opportunity all hopefully still have some funding for that. Rensselaer County does have a continuum of care, so if folks have access to a computer and can look that up, that might be a good mechanism to use to get connected to services. But I just have to say there's no United Tenants. There's no real true tenant organization in Troy, unfortunately.
And how would they contact you?
So United Tenants has got our hotline. That's 518-436-8997. And you press 3 and you're directed to that. You can leave a message about your housing issue, or just want to, if you just want to connect about what we're up to, that's just a great way to reach us. And then we have an email address as well. It's info@unitedtenantsalbany.org.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in.
Yes.
And that was Laura Feltz of the United Tenants of Albany speaking about tenant rights in the city of Troy.
For those just tuning in, I'm Chris Scully.
And I'm Dave Pueblo. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to find out about the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And now let's go to L.A. Kaufman, author and activist, as she speaks about her upcoming workshop entitled How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance, that will be taking place here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in North Troy this Thursday at 7 p.m.
This is a book about how and why we protest, and how movements and the forms of protest have changed over time. It juxtaposes the most famous protest in American history, the 1963 March on Washington, with what now stands as the largest protest in American history, which is the 2017 Women's Marches that happened the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated.
And why did you write this book?
I've been a grassroots organizer for decades. I first became involved in organizing in 1981. So I've seen a lot of movements come and go. And I've been haunted by some of the experiences I had with mass protest. I was the mobilizing coordinator for some of the largest protests in U.S. history, the huge anti-war marches of 2003 and 2004, which brought huge numbers of people into the streets, but didn't do what they accomplished, you know, didn't accomplish what they set out to do, didn't stop the war. So after Donald Trump took office and there was this upsurge of protests that, in terms of scale, is larger than anything we've ever seen before in U.S. history, I really wanted to think hard and explain what I saw that was distinctive about this moment and where I see grounds for hope.
So we don't want to give away the ending of the book, but can you tell us a bit about what you found?
The way that protests are organized can actually tell us a whole lot about the way that movements are organized. And so I went deep into the archives to look at some aspects of the 63 March that most people don't know. It's the famous occasion where Dr. King gave his I Have a Dream speech, and it's a, you know, it's a mythic moment in American history. But from an organizing point of view, it represented some of the later stages of a model that was being replaced, a model that relied on charismatic leadership, on top-down organizing, that marginalized women, and that rejected some different kinds of organizing models that women, particularly black women in the civil rights movements, were putting forward. And when you fast forward and you look at both what happened with the women's marches in 2017 and how the resistance to Trump has been organized, the distinctive ways that people have been working since 2017, there are, you know, these major changes to a kind of decentralized, bottom-up, women-led style of organizing, which, you know, has its strengths and its weaknesses, but definitely represents something very new.
And what do you think accounts for the change in the ways that protests play out?
A lot of this is work that's been quietly happening behind the scenes, you know, over a long period of time. My first book, called Direct Action, looked at the history of disruptive protest in the U.S. To look at some of the ways this has happened. But there's also a way in which these shifts are tied to other changes, like the rise of the Internet, which has facilitated that kind of very local, decentralized organizing where you just, you know, pull together a small group of people and make something happen.
So when I think of the golden age of protests in my lifetime, it was the period when anti-corporate globalization protests were huge and were exhilarating, kind of ecstatic celebrations of protest. That changed a lot by the time Bush was elected came into office. What happened?
That upbeat sense, you know, I remember it well, the feeling of that what we would call a carnival against capitalism, that visionary, upbeat, celebratory side of that movement. But that was also a movement that met with enormous police repression. The crackdown against that kind of organizing was really very far-reaching and often very militarized. And the other thing that really changed was 9/11. And after 9/11, that kind of carnivalesque protest was in the wrong key. It didn't really fit with the somber mood of the country. So the wave of organizing that followed in the Bush years that led up to the huge protests trying to stop the Iraq War and the much smaller protests protesting it once it happened, had a more subdued quality and also didn't have that same feeling of creative openness. They felt more, and this is as someone who helped create those protests, they felt more formulaic, much more like, you know, restaging kinds of protests we'd seen before.
So I recall the protests that you refer to, the anti-Iraq war protests in 2003 and 2004. I went to New York City to be part of that crowd and with my family, and was just shocked at the what you call a militarized presence there. Everybody was forced to walk in pens, and they were forced to walk for miles before they got to the actual protest site. And the police refused to let people use the restrooms along the way. If you left the everybody was penned in with barricades, and if you left the pen, you weren't able to get back in. It was really extraordinary repression, as you say, of the right to protest. And that seems to be the new normal for these things. Do you find that?
I mean, it is. I mean, not exactly. I mean, that was really extraordinary in that we were, you know, they refused us a permit to march. We had asked for a permit to march and not just hold a stationary rally. It is true that this trend has come and gone in New York City of how much they use those protest pens. And they did, for instance, for the anniversaries of the Women's March, the marches uptown, they used this pen corralling system that they had pioneered in February 2003. So that comes and goes. But, for all the outrages committed under the Trump administration, on the whole, it's certainly in cities, we haven't seen the same level of militarized repression. We've seen more protests than we saw in the Bush era and less direct repression of it so far. We have not been seeing the riot squads and the goon squads and the tear gas and the kinds of militarized responses that we saw to anti-globalization protests that framed that anti-war protest and that some other movements like Black Lives Matter have experienced. On the whole, the big protests against Trump, the policing has been fairly reasonable, I would say.
Interesting.
And that to me, it represents political space that people fought for and that we need to hold and expand. It's, at this point, for the various, egregious, awful things unfolding before us in the Trump era, one thing to note is that the space for protest has not been shut down so far.
So the last protest I went to was the one in New York in 2003, and it was because it was so brutal, and also because 500,000 people in New York City and millions around the world weren't enough to make a difference in that fight. And I thought, why am I doing this? I'm taking basically 2 days to go and protest. It doesn't work. We need to do something else. What do you find other people with that attitude?
Oh, yeah, that February 15th, 2003 discouraged an entire generation. And that was one of the most effective things that George Bush did by brushing off that day of protest. He managed to leave millions of people feeling discouraged and disempowered in the way that you describe. Part of it was just the objective fact that we had lost, that it was you don't win every movement, you don't win every fight, and it was a devastating loss. The consequences of that, foolish, illegal war are still rebounding around the world. I think part of the problem that February 15th, 2003 represents is one about expectations. And when you say protest doesn't work, which is a common refrain, many people say that, or if they don't just state it outright, they ask, like, does protest still work? What my book explores is, well, what does it mean to say protest works? Define what working means, right? There's many different kinds of changes that protests can help produce. There's a dominant narrative around protest working, where, in the case of 2003, it would have worked if it had stopped the war. But generally speaking, what people are asking for when they're asking whether or not a protest works is whether or not it leads to short-term policy change or legislative change. As I explore, there are many, many other things that protests can do. There are many kinds of protests. They work in different ways. They accomplish different things. The process of fighting for social change is a long-haul fight. And sometimes a protest can push for a specific policy change. But in the case of the women's marches that kicked off the resistance to Trump, there weren't any policy demands. That wasn't what it was about. It was about something else. It was about a sense of collective empowerment. It was about regaining the sense of hope that if people acted together and joined together, they could create change. It was about feeling in your body the magnitude of the opposition to Trump and feeling that sense of the force on our side. that in turn, I think, you know, has translated into a lot of other ongoing work and ongoing change. A lot of times with movement work, the most crucial thing is morale. And sometimes what, you know, the February 15th, 2003 certainly was a blow to morale. But we saw how the women's marches really energized people and gave people a sense of hope and possibility that they hadn't had in that period between the election and the inauguration. So these questions are always grounded in a specific moment. You can't just say across the board that protest works or it doesn't work. You have to dig a little deeper.
And once again, that was L.A. Kaufman, who will be here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media on Thursday at 7 p.m. to complete her workshop. Please join us at this free community event if you can.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady.
For our next segment, we're going to hear from two of HMM's very own, Elizabeth Press, as they are interviewed by Imani Taylor and on their experiences as a queer parent.
Hi, this is Imani Taylor, and I'm here again with Elizabeth Press, also known as EP, this time to talk to her about her experience being a queer parent in 2019. Hello, EP.
Hi, Imani. Thanks for having me back.
So you have a son. How old is he?
Almost two. Two in April.
Two in April. Happy early birthday.
Thanks. We almost made it 2 years.
And you are in a same-sex relationship, correct?
True. I have a wife.
And how long have you two been married?
We actually only got married right before our child, Sylvan, was born because we were a bit nervous about the current political climate and having a child as a queer couple. So, but we've been together now for about 6 years.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
So what was it like raising Sylvan, explaining to him the world, you know? Like, he looks around and he sees all these traditional families, wife, a husband, and a kid or two. So how was it explaining your family dynamic to him?
Well, Sylvan is only 2 years old, so this is a journey we're just really beginning. Sylvan's understanding of families and what is quote-unquote the norm is really just coming to be. We, though, constantly talk about families and different families and chosen families and what makes up a family. And we have our family dynamic, which we have and try to have a lot of other families that are either single parents or grandparents mm-hmm. raising kids or, you know, straight traditional families or two dads. We try to expose our child to a lot of different family dynamics. And we also have a bunch of different books. So whether it's on gender, whether it's on class, whether it's on, you know, racial diversity, we try to, you know, what we read with our child, we try to expose them to a broad view of the world that is maybe not as most kids were raised, which is reflective of their own personal experience, which might lead more to a mom and a dad and a kid. Mm. And Sylvan knows that he has a mom and a mappa. And
I was going to ask what he calls you.
Yeah, he calls me mappa. And
how do you spell that?
M-A-P-A. But as he might say, it is mappa. Mappa.
That's
and
cute.
Sometimes he calls me mama, but okay. For the most part, I'm the mappa and Angela is the mama.
Cute. So does he ask a lot of questions regarding parents, like types of relationships?
Not really. I mean, we do a bit of a childcare cooperative with some of our friends. And one day a week, he is taken care of by a friend who goes by Daddy. So sometimes, you know, in learning people's names, he will either call me EP or Mappa, and he'll call Angela, my partner, either Mama or Mama Angela. So he's like learning people's names in association with who they are, like Uncle Cameron or what other relative we might have. And so when he first started hanging out there, he was a bit confused and he started calling this other parent daddy as well, or, you know, the other mom who goes in her house by mommy, started calling her mommy. So he's too young to really understand. And we explained to him that they, you know, as who he is, he should call them by their first names. And he does, but it's still very new and confusing. He's not even 2 years old yet.
Mm-hmm. How'd you come up with Mappa?
Well, I really wanted to be called something that was gender neutral, that was not really, you know, some people go by Baba in this world, or some people go by Ren for parent. And I wasn't quite sure which one to go with, but for a while, Sylvan was calling us both Mama, and it was rather confusing and didn't feel quite right. And if you've ever seen Transparent, there's a Mappa in there.
I haven't. I've been wanting to.
So I sort of felt like that was, it was a sweet way of having Ma in the name, but not quite being a Ma.
I agree. Would you mind sharing how Sylvan came to be?
Sure. I am the non-birthing parent of our child. So my wife, Angela, carried Sylvan. We used donor sperm. And okay. That's how he's here today.
So you got a while before you have to explain that.
For sure.
When he realizes that, you know, everyone has a father.
Well, not everyone has a father.
Well, everyone has a sperm donor, if you will.
Yeah. But yeah, we. I think it will be part of our constant dialogue with him how he's here and who's his family. And don't think we will wait until, you know, he's a teenager to have these conversations. It's going to be part of our raising of him.
Are you looking to have more children in the future?
Wow, you're getting right into it, aren't you? I think we've met our number, but you know, in an interview, you never want to say something like that of being so solidified in your decisions. But I feel I feel complete in our family structure right now. But we'll see what happens. As like a queer family, as a non-traditional family in an area of upstate New York where there are a lot of less queer folks around than New York City where we came from, I think it's always constantly on our mind, this idea of not only our relationship, but how we're raising our child. And we really do try pretty hard to not force gender norms onto our child. So, you know, our child gets hand-me-down clothing and it can be something that leans more toward like a gendered boy's clothing or gendered female girl's clothing. And we let our child decide what he's going to wear and how he's going to present. And as of now, we haven't cut Sylvan's hair at age 2. That's not really based on a gendered thing per se, but it's touching on some Jewish tradition where you don't often cut your child's hair until the age of 3. So, you know, we're conscious of how our child presents in the world. And, you know, some people use she, her, hers pronouns with Sylvan, and we don't correct them. You know, we're not going to force gender onto our kid, and we're not going to also forcibly not have, you know, gender as part of the conversation. So as of now, we use male pronouns with him for the most part, or gender neutral pronouns with him. But we will, you know, it's a part of the raising is to have gender be part of the conversation as well.
I read an article recently about how parents of newborn children are not assigning a gender to their baby. They're called babies, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's cute. Just letting the child decide for themselves.
Yeah, and I mean, we haven't exactly done it in the way that we've just used gender-neutral pronouns with Sylvan, but we really are not gender-policing people around him or trying to, you know, force him into a gender identity that doesn't suit him. It's just, I don't think at Sylvan's age. He knows yet. So mm-hmm. we're pretty flexible with terminology in terms of gender with him and gender expression in terms of like what we're putting in him in terms of his attire.
So I know he's not in school yet, but does he have like play dates or interact with other kids a lot?
And yeah.
like, what have you noticed among his interactions with other kids in terms of gender, sexuality?
I mean, they're just seemingly like kids these days. I mean, we have our friends have a child with long hair who is a male child. And we have this book, Uni the Unicorn, that has supposedly this female kid that I always use, you know, kid instead of like she or girl mm-hmm. when I read the book to Sylvan. And Sylvan started, when we get to the page that this kid is on, started naming this kid his friend who is a boy with long hair. And we just go with it. So he's starting to recognize the world and similarities with people and what people look like. And it's just actually having these, you know, that, oh, that looks like X, Y, or Z person. And I see how you can see that. That seems familiar. And he's starting to do it across the board, whether it's gender, whether it's race, whether, you know, it's all sorts of things. He's just a sponge at almost 2 years old and absorbing mm-hmm. the world. And for us, it's just how to keep all of these ideas that he's expressing in constant conversation and not shutting them down. And, you know, I think a lot of us, or both me and my partner, were raised in families where you don't necessarily talk about gender, where you don't necessarily talk about race, where you don't discover till later on that you are a specific race different than other people. So mm-hmm. we are just trying to figure out a way that to normalize these things and the differences in people and honor them.
Well, that's great.
Thanks.
I think you're doing a good job.
Oh, thanks.
What do I know about parenting? I'm 21 years old, but I think you're doing a good job.
I appreciate it.
Well, I guess that's it, really.
All right. Well, we'll check in another time.
Thank you so much for speaking with me about this topic.
Of course.
Once again, that was two of our media correspondents, Imani Talier and Elizabeth Press, with some insight into life as a queer parent.
And now we move into our last segment, which we had planned to speak with Shelley Hegan from Planned Parenthood about Title X, but through an unfortunate miscommunication, that's going to be rescheduled, probably running on Thursday, and we're looking forward to that. But we are joined today by our very own Melissa Bromley, and this is actually a great thing because the spring season is kicking off at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and there's a lot of really interesting stuff happening. So welcome, Melissa.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah, the spring season kicked off on Friday night with Resiliencia, an album release party for Taina Asili. It was wonderful, and I'm still floating, and I'm looking forward to a full season of wonderful, exciting events. I was actually on the show on Thursday talking to Daekwon and Bosch about the season, and I'll pick up where we left off then.
That sounds great.
We ran through some of the first major events that we have. I recommend checking out mediasanctuary.org if you missed that. And I'll pick up with What is Democracy with visiting filmmaker Astra Taylor. Okay, all the events here are always wonderful and amazing. and it's true. But it's also true that there are some events that get people really excited. And usually I can tell by the way people are talking about events as before they even happen that they're going to be special. And this is one that I am seeing people who know about film and filmmaking being very excited about. I think Astra is a rock star and it's special that she's coming here. And so she's coming to screen her newest film, What is Democracy? And she's also going to be leading a workshop here. That's Wednesday, April 24th. And she's coming for the workshop from 4 to 5:30. It's a workshop on media and activism because she herself is a media activist. And the film screening's at 7. So the next event after that is a celebration of Pete Seeger's 100th birthday. He would have mm-hmm. been 100 this year. And you probably will continue to hear about events happening throughout the region and nation to honor this special dude who is so very beloved. And this happens to be another event that people are really excited about. It's not the typical kind of event that we have here. But, you know, a lot of our community who are activists or care about the environment are just music lovers.
Yeah, it's definitely in the spirit of the sanctuary, frankly. I mean, Pete Seeger was such an involved activist, and his music has become so iconic in our culture that, I mean, it's been several years since he passed away, but his presence is still there for sure.
Certainly, especially in this region with all that he did for the Hudson River and Clearwater. He has a special place in a lot of people's hearts. So that's going to be a great event. It's on May 4th. And it's co-sponsored by The Egg. And the musicians who are coming to honor him, Richie and Rosie, are apparently very well regarded in the folk community. And I know that's going to be a special one as well. So May 4th, that's a free event. It's at 7 p.m. and you should come out. The next one, Dave, you might even be better, or and Chris, both of you guys are Troy Bike Rescue volunteers. Yeah. The Bike Rescue is on this block here. They have been for many years. They're good friends of the sanctuary, and they have this annual fundraiser here every May. Why don't you guys tell us about it?
Well, I think actually this is a good opportunity to give them a plug as well, because I know that they're looking for a, I don't know what the exact title is, but
volunteer coordinator is what I've heard.
Is it? I thought it was more like shop manager.
Yeah, shop manager. But essentially that's what it is. So the idea is to be there, like bottom lining every open shop, and also coordinate volunteers and train them on the shop tenants and how the shop works. So if anybody who's listening to this isn't familiar, the Troy Bike Rescue is a non-for-profit in the industry or in the local area that is dedicated to saving bicycles from the waste stream and empowering people through the education of bicycle maintenance. And so this is a celebration of them and what they do, as well as a fundraising effort and a big party.
Yep.
Yeah. And so it's a great year to come out because they are hiring. It's a big step forward for the organization. And it's a great time. It's just a wonderful party every time. And that is May 11th, 5 to 8 p.m. And that's a suggested donation of $20. And I hope you all come. And then the last big event of the season is Freedom Festival. I think it's our 7th annual Freedom Festival. It's on June 8th from 3 to 6 p.m. It'll be an outdoor event with free music, free arts activities, free food. And it's going to kick off our summer concert series, our very first ever summer concert series called Spirit of the Suffragettes. And this year, we are honored to have Faye Victor and the Mutations for Justice headlining Freedom Festival. It's going to be an excellent event.
That's great. Well, we're looking forward to all these things happening. We're about out of time for this show, though. So thank you for joining us.
And
that concludes our show. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dave Pablo.
And I'm Chris Skelly. Our engineer tonight is Alexis Goldsmith. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or a tender confession, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Also, be sure to tune in 7 to 10 weeknights for Jazz Sanctuary, a wonderful celebration of all that is creative, dedicated to supporting jazz in the Hudson Mohawk region.
And as a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in helping with our radio effort, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org or just stop by one of the weekly meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. held right here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.